Welcome to the Holistic Wealth and Health Podcast. Your co-hosts, Jason Smith and Brian Bibbo, will inspire and teach you how to prosper in your mind, body, and spirit, not just your financial life. Joining forces with field experts, Jason and Brian are here to help you focus on what matters most in your life, living well.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Brian Bibbo to the J.L. Smith Group Holistic Wealth and Health Podcast. I'm super excited today to have a friend here on the podcast, the Assistant Professor of Surgery for the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. Trevor Murray's here. Glad to have you.
Glad to be here, Brian. Thanks.
Yeah, I want to start right out the gate with, before I was introduced to you, I heard a story about you. And the story was that even when you were like 6, 7, 8 years of age, you knew what you wanted to be, and you wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. Now, how true is that? Can you give us a little background?
That's actually partially true. So I tell folks, in sixth grade, we had to write a paragraph about what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I actually did put an orthopedic surgeon, which is funny. There's no doctors in my family. I'm the first in my family. I think really the writing was on the wall in sixth grade that an athletic career was not in front of me. Yet I loved athletics. And so I thought, okay, this is the closest I can get to athletics as a profession.
Yeah. See, it's funny. When I was growing up, I actually wanted to be a doctor. That's what I originally set out. And my mindset was like to be able to help people. That's what I've always wanted to do. But the thing I don't like is needles. For whatever reason, it just turned me off. I don't know if I have a phobia for it. Like blood doesn't bother me, any of that. But needles just scared me. So that turned me off. And now I've gotten to this financial industry and everything else. I mean, the writing was on the wall for me too. I've been it since I was 16 years old, working for my uncle as a stockbroker in downtown Cleveland, helping him the nights, the weekends, and the summers. Did that all the way through college. So similar backgrounds. But what we always hear, there's a lot of schooling to become a doctor or an orthopedic surgeon. Can you go a little bit on that background? Like, how did that come about? Where did you start? How many years was it?
Sure. I think it's interesting. That's something that puts it into a little bit of perspective is the time, basically the time it takes somebody to go from kindergarten to graduate is the time I have in postgraduate, close. So it's 4 years of undergrad. But then after 4 years of undergrad, I did 6 years of residency. Now, most orthopedic residencies are 5 years. We had a research year built in, so that's an extra year. And then another year of fellowship. So 11 years post-undergrad to become a full-fledged, if you will, practicing orthopedic surgeon. So it's a long haul. What's funny is I was just thinking about this the other day, that while you're doing it, you think, oh my gosh, am I ever going to get there, right? It's just one hurdle after the next. And now I sit here and I reflect back and I'm in my 13th year of practice. And it's like, wow, it went so fast. So it's like other things in life, right? Where you're like, oh my gosh, this is taking forever. And then once it happens, it's just a blink of an eye, quite frankly.
Man. So you had a lot of school in your time. There's no doubt about it.
There's a lot of school. It's a long, you have to be dedicated. You have to want to do it. There's no doubt.
Yeah. I have a friend of mine who does the lifelighting for the hospitals around here and everything else, and to be a helicopter pilot. But he works with like individuals like you, and he shares his appreciation for what you guys do, the reconstructive, everything else. But let's think about this. Is like, you're replacing joints. What else do you run into on a day-to-day basis of what you actually do?
So for me, I mean, I can answer that for me personally. I think if we're looking at a broader scale of what orthopedic surgeons do, it's really practice dependent. So if you're going to live in a relatively large city like Cleveland, most people are subspecialized. So my day in and day out life literally is total knee replacement, total hip replacement, partial knee replacement. I'll throw in an occasional knee scope here and there, but it is a very focused practice. Now, I do cover call. I don't happen to work at a level one trauma center. And so kind of the things you may see on TV and the things that sound exciting, I don't take care of on a regular basis, but certainly the hip fracture, femur fracture, tibia fracture, things like that. When I'm on call, I do take care of those things as well. But by and large, my practice is elective. 98% of it is planned out and is total joint replacement of the lower extremity.
Got it. So you specialize in the lower extremities. That's good. But what is the age ranges? When do you start seeing like the joint replacement? Is it a lot of athletes at younger ages? And then Is it just, do you see elderly people falling? Is there a common occurrence?
I would say this, to show you my spectrum, the youngest hip replacement I've ever done is a 15-year-old, which again, that's a one-off due to a congenital hip disease that patient had. He actually did great. And then my oldest patient that I've ever replaced a joint on is 105, right? So wow. there's the spectrum. Now, that being said, I couldn't tell you what my average age of patient is, but yeah. Certainly most patients are over 40 and most patients are younger than 90 in general. So I know that's a pretty big range, but yeah. So there you go. I get to see it all.
No, that was awesome. That excited me to see. You gave me the sides of the bell curve that I kind of wanted to hear. 105? Like, 105. That is wild.
I mean, to think what that person saw in their life. It's unbelievable, right?
Right.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
The world wars, everything else.
Yeah, it is incredible.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. So let's talk about prevention. Like, when we think about these hip and these joint replacements, is there any preventative measures our audience should be considering to try to take care of their joints better? Like an individual like me, I have psoriatic arthritis. And what I hear with this autoimmune disease is like my joints are going to deteriorate over time. So in general, is there something that people could be doing? Like you hear taking fish oil. I'm not asking you to subscribe anything here or give me a prescription, but what would you say in general?
I think in general, and there are different causes to where people get to the point to see me and need joint replacement, something like an inflammatory arthropathy. A lot of that is medication. But as far as lifestyle choice, I think what we're getting at here, right? Because getting to the point where you have end-stage arthritic disease for whatever the reason of a knee or hip, it is absolutely multifactorial, right? There are genetic factors at play that people can't manage, they can't control. But a lot of them people can. I think the biggest one has to do with every part of health is weight, quite frankly. We know that obesity increases your risk of needing a joint replacement. So trying to keep that managed, low impact exercising. This is always a tough one for me. I have a hard time telling somebody to stop doing something they really enjoy that we know may cause wear and tear on their joints. I do think there's some concessions that we all can make, but I'm not somebody who's going to sit in clinic and tell whoever to stop running if they really enjoy it. I'm just gonna say these are the repercussions. And maybe if you could not train for marathons later in life and take up cycling, there's other things we can do. So I would say, I know it's a roundabout answer, but low impact exercising. I mean, things that are good for your cardiovascular health are typically good for your joint health. Keep the weight off. I mean, we talked about it before we came on here, even though maybe the facts were a little off. When you look at weight with certain activities, specifically descending stairs, for example, you experience 9 times body weight when you come downstairs with force across your knee joint. So if you lose 10 pounds, that's 90 pounds less force across that joint. So whether it's stopping the progression of disease, maybe, but more importantly, I think what it's doing, it is subduing the symptoms that you do have from the condition that exists, and that staves off the need for joint replacement.
Yeah, that puts in a huge perspective. The example you gave about going down the stairs, taking off 10 pounds is like a 90 pounds difference stress on the joint. So I want to continue on me. Like, and let's just hypothetically, I'm coming to see you. And I do have that psoriatic arthritis. It was passed down through generations of my family. But the exercise I typically do 5 to 7 days a week is I'm on a treadmill. I'm going at 4.0 speed. 2 miles takes me 30 minutes. So I'm not like excessively like running by any means. And then for the first mile, I'll do a 4 or 5 incline. And the second mile, I'll do pretty much flat. And my goal, and here's my thoughts, right? Just being open and transparent is like, I've seen what my grandfather went through. I've seen what my mother went through with this. And I'm just trying to keep mobile now so I don't lose the mobility, right? Do I go out there and run by any means? No, not at all. What would you say about something like that?
I think it's great. I think, you know, especially when you talk about a treadmill, especially contemporary treadmills are really designed to decrease the impact of the load while you're running. But again, what you hit on is staying mobile, right? So I'll see patients who have the same level of arthritis on their x-ray, and person X is extremely mobile, stays active, and is able to maintain a certain lifestyle. And patient Y has not been mobile, right? And so then it just becomes this engrossing problem of lack of mobility. They get physically deconditioned. They can't move. The joint becomes stiffer. And so again, not so much preventing the loss of cartilage, because that's what we're talking about here in the joint, but more the preservation of their lifestyle and the ability to get around with what they do have. So absolutely. I mean, screaming from the rooftop, low impact exercising, stay active. Even if it's walk 2 miles around the block, do whatever you can to stay active, because when you lose it, you lose it. And it's really, really hard to get back. We'll talk about the amount of time it takes to become deconditioned. It's 3 to 5x that to get it back. So somebody who comes to us who needs a joint replacement, who has unfortunately, and now sometimes to no fault of their own, don't get me wrong, but has not been mobile, has not been active, man, to work back once we give them a nice new joint is a long, long haul. So the things you're doing, I would say, keep it up.
I appreciate that feedback. We've never talked about this before, so I just think we throw it out there for everyone to hear. But when it comes to these joint replacements, is there a reason you would want to put them off? Like, is there a reason to delay them, or is it just stubbornness? Give me a little feedback there.
Sure. I think the old dogma was, you know, wait as long as you can because you're going to need another surgery, right? Because these do have a finite lifespan. Now, not to get too into the weeds, I would argue that contemporary hip replacements, that lifespan is really long. I don't think I can quote you a number, but I would feel very comfortable saying 25 to 30 years. And it may be longer. Knee replacement's not quite as long. So again, people used to tell patients, wait as long as you can because you're going to need another surgery. And I think there's some value to that. But for me, as far as waiting as long as you can, it is more about what symptoms do you have today? How significant are they? Are they just a nuisance? Well, unfortunately, being diabetic and not being able to eat certain things is a nuisance, right? You have to make some adjustments. So if somebody comes to me, for example, and says, look, I used to run marathons, or I used to run 6 miles a day, and now I only run 4 miles a day. I mean, I understand, but continue to run 4 miles a day. Like, that's not a reason to get a joint replacement. Okay. So again, I would let symptoms guide the decision. So if you're 45 and you have terrible knee arthritis, and it is a huge negative impact on your day in and day out life, to me, there's no reason to waste these years when you can have a good solution to your problem. And then we'll deal with what comes down the road, as opposed to waiting for some hypothetical issue down the road. So for me, it's really one, x-ray findings, the condition has to exist. But then once the condition exists, it is simply how symptomatic is that patient? How negatively does it impact their life? And part of my job is to, I don't know, coach is the right word, but to try to really get at, okay, really, how bad is it? Like I said, is it you're not 20 anymore and your knee kind of bothers you? Or is when I get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, it is a struggle. I have second thoughts about going out to dinner with my family because of how bad my knee hurts. Okay, then it's time to seriously consider knee replacement.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing, Bain, if it's really debuilding your lifestyle, that's when you can consider it. But if like it hurts, but you can survive with the pain, it might not be the right time. And I use my grandfather as an example. He had both knees replaced in his 50s, and then they lasted over 20 years each. And my grandpa, God rest his soul, has been dead for almost a decade now. He got it replaced when he was 70, but that's even the older knees. And I'm sure modern medicine has taken us to a new frontier and has worked out these different joints and everything else. So with that being said, do you see, like, when you started your residency till now, how technology and modern medicine is changing this?
Yes. So I would say that there's a couple of important parts when you look at joint replacement. One is the bearing surface, meaning the two parts that rub against each other, right? Those are the things that are going to wear out. And then two, the fixation. How is that implant fixated to the patient's bone? And so in total hip replacements for a very long time, most of them are done cementless, meaning there's biologic fixation. The body, the bone, it's impressive, actually grows into the implant. So that fixation is essentially lifelong, potentially, again, without some caveats that we don't need to go down that road. And then you look at the bearing surface. And in today's world, when we look at what's called highly cross-linked polyethylene, which is just fancy medical plastic, basically, and a ceramic ball, when those two mate, the wear is almost immeasurable. And so with that technology, hips can last a long time. When we look at the knee side, again, we've got better plastic now that lasts longer. But we're also, it's been around a while, but we're now revisiting it. Is cementless fixation on the knee side, because typically those are cemented or glued into place. And so just like grout in your bathroom, eventually it kind of wears out and breaks down. And so that was an issue with knee replacement. like your grandfather, though, some of them lasted for decades for reasons we can't really explain. But again, to get back to the fixation, we're using cementless fixation on the knee side more and more. And the hope is that that will create a longer lifespan for that implant. And then there's all kinds of other technologies as far as doing the surgery better with robotic-assisted surgery to allow us to make it a little more patient-specific and then implement that surgery more accurately for the patient.
Yeah, that's great. So I haven't heard that one yet, but I want to clarify it is you're using some sort of, most knees and hips are now some sort of a factor of medical grade plastic, right?
Well, only one part, sorry. The major part, there's in a hip, there's four parts. The cup that's metal, the stem that's metal, and then there's a plastic liner that goes into the cup and a ceramic ball that goes onto the stem. So we've made improvements in the plastic piece that has existed for a long time. It's just there's been improvements made in that. So the implant's not plastic. Sorry if I misled you there.
That's why I wanted clarification, and I'm glad I asked. So what I'm hearing you say is like the ball joint in the hip, you've modified the plastic to make it less wear on the actual socket. One time I flew off a four-wheeler being reckless, and I fractured my hip socket, all right?
Oh, wow.
And I popcorned up in the air. I just happened to hit a tree stump those wild tree stumps that jump out at you. It jumped out at me, hit the front tire, and I flew up in there, and thank God I was on sand because it was a sand court, so I lay in the sand. But I had a partial fracture. It didn't fracture all the way through. It was like a hairline fracture. And it doesn't bother me at all now. Do you ever see that coming back and bothering me anytime? I mean, I know it's hard to tell, right?
We would call that post-traumatic arthritis. And I would argue that could come back to haunt you. Now, a non-displaced acetabular fracture, your hope is that the cartilage was relatively unharmed. But that's the most important part. Our cartilage has no ability to repair itself. Bone does fabulously well. So yeah, I would argue that may come back to haunt you. It'll be a toss up. Is it the psoriatic arthritis or is it the fact that you threw yourself off on a four wheeler?
I see. I'd be open with this, and the people that listen to this, I know they're going to be emailing me, reach out to me, like, why were you on the four wheeler doing this? So we talked about weight before, Trevor. And what about like smoking or drinking? Is there any correlation between smoking and drinking and joint, or is there no studies out there? What would you say?
I would say there's a study, and I hate to, again, this is not judgmental, but there is a study to show smoking is related negatively to almost every part of our health, including joint health. I don't know of any drinking studies unless you drink too much and you have a trauma and then have a fracture, and then that can lead to issues with your joint. But I will tell you 100%, when we look at smoking and drinking, it absolutely negatively impacts the outcome of surgery should you get to the point of needing a joint replacement. I mean, without a doubt.
So what I'm hearing you say is like smoking and drinking in your rehab stage is obviously you shouldn't be doing it, right? We're not saying anyone should be doing it, but the recovery is what, lengthened greatly?
Well, smoking specifically, it increases your risk of complication and most importantly, your risk of infection. Nicotine is really bad for wound healing. And if you have issues with wound healing, you can have issues with infection. And when you look at total joint replacements with all that metal and plastic that we're putting into somebody's body, if there's an infection, it's a huge deal to the point that the 5-year survivorship after a total joint infection is equivalent to many types of cancer. And so something like smoking, that modifiable risk factor is one that absolutely should be modified by the patient.
That is a huge thing you just said right there. That yeah. If you have an infection after joint, and like it, the equivalent to longevity in life is similar to some cancers, correct?
And for somebody who maybe has gone through this, but if they've gone through it, they would tell you it is not like, hey, we throw some antibiotics at it and this thing goes away. It's a surgical issue. It's a really big deal. And so when we look at getting to the point of doing joint replacement on patients, we certainly look at their risk profile. Some of them are controllable. Some of them are not. And something like smoking certainly is. And so we strongly encourage, and it's sometimes based on their other risk profile, it's a requirement before surgery.
Yeah. So we talked about exercise as like something that could be preventative or helping from replacing joints and giving you more longevity. But what else would you say? What are some great factors we can share with the audience here of like, how do you make sure your joints last longer?
I think we've touched on most of them. I wish I could give you the magic sauce. I have a lot of patients who come see me premature of needing a joint replacement. I walk in and say, hey, you need your joint replaced? No. And I go, well, hey, okay. But, and they want to know, what can I do? It's tough. Other than the things we've just said, low impact exercise, the healthy diet. There's no supplements that I'm aware of that, that stave off joint replacement or arthritis. I will, as a little aside, there's certainly no evidence yet that like stem cell injections, for example, those are kind of a craze, can one, stop the progression of arthritis, or two, grow cartilage. We unequivocally know that we aren't there yet. Now, there's people way smarter than me working on those issues, and I don't know if it's going to be in my lifetime, but at some point, those types of things will exist. But again, it's just overall health. I have this conversation a lot. The things that you would think of that are good for your heart and lungs, and that's good for your joints. Like we just said, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but it's keep the weight off, stay active. All the things we all should do, but it's hard. It's easier said than done, right? I mean, I have it in my own life where I'm like, oh gosh, why am I not exercising as much as I should? Boy, I shouldn't have eaten that. There's all kinds of things.
No, that's great. And I appreciate that. So stay away from the potato chips. Don't smoke. But if I come in for a knee replacement, you replace my knee, what are some of the best, I don't know, physical therapies I could do? Or what would be the course of action to getting my life back and my mobility back after one of these?
Sure. It's a process. Just the nuts and bolts of it. The surgery's done, and a lot of our patients go home the same day. If not the same day, the next day. And as far as the ins and outs of therapy, there's 3 weeks of home therapy for patients. And then there's outpatient therapy. I tell my patients all the time, listen, I'm going to work really hard for an hour. You have to work really hard for 6 to 8 weeks, and we'll both be happy with the result. And so it's a big investment. Early on, it's physical therapy geared towards range of motion. There's a finite window of how much that joint's going to move post-surgery. And so if they're not moving it and the scar tissue builds up, it won't move. So that's kind of the first level of therapy. And then secondarily, we look at strength and endurance. And that's a process. It's an 18, sometimes 24-month process before you say, okay, this is my peak outcome. Now, again, 80 to 90% of it is long before that. So the therapy, again, directed more at pain control, joint motion, and then secondarily strength and endurance. And that's guided by a physical therapist. And then patients will do the exercises on their own as well.
So it's a lot of just continuing to move it, range of motion. One of the things that I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is after a hip replacement, I get my hip replaced today, they make me stand up.
Yes.
So why is that?
Get you moving. I mean, bad things happen when people are sedentary for whatever the reason, whatever the cause of that being sedentary is, whether it's an illness or just don't want to move around, bad things happen. And so there's some risk factors after joint surgery, specifically like blood clots in your leg or lungs. And we know that mobility helps decrease that. That's certainly, when you ask me about technology changing over the course of my time in this field, I would argue technology has changed. But I think one of the bigger things that's changed is the delivery of the care and the idea of early mobilization. And so to your point, patients after knee and hip replacement, they are up day of surgery. Like I said, a lot of them go home the same day. Now they're using a walker, they're using an assist device, but they're up and moving. Absolutely.
Got it. So if individual comes in and let's say you look at both their knees and one's worse than the other, but the other one's still bad, I need one knee replaced. Do you ever do two at the same time? Or in addition to that question is there a certain suggested period in between the two? How you perform and when you perform?
That's a great question. One that's hard to answer. it's often the case that patients have bilateral hips or bilateral knees. Specifically with knees, we will do bilateral knees from time to time. I have it coming up on Friday. In that setting, that patient has to be basically risk-free. So the things we talked about, obesity, smoking, poor health, those cannot exist because bilateral knee replacements increases the risk of that surgery. And so you want them to be at a very low risk level to begin with. So there are times where we'll do it. It used to be more popular than it is now. Now, I think a harder question to answer is, if you do one, what's the timing of the other one? There's varying data in the literature. I've gone back and forth myself. I still do. 3 months was kind of my magic time. I would tell somebody, listen, if you're doing well from your first knee, we can do your other knee 3 months later. I honestly have started to push that time frame out a little bit more. And I think it's been beneficial. Now, understandably, because people have their lives going on, right? And so they want to pack this into short periods of time, whether it's what kind of time can they get off work, their granddaughter's getting married, whatever the case to me, very real things in their life. I do think from anecdotally, this is not a study, that I think 6 months is probably a better window, but we will do them 3 months apart.
Got it. So that's great information just for anyone that needs those things done. In your career, what has been one of the best things you've experienced, would you say?
It's the everyday little things. I'm fortunate in the things I get to do. I do some big cases. We call them podium presentation type cases where people would be awed by the x-ray. And I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back. And those are great. But it's just the little day in and day out things where somebody comes in to see me 3 months post-op. They give me a hug and they said, I've never enjoyed my grandson's football game in the last 3 years like I did today. And I know that sounds kind of goofy, but it really is. It's those just simple moments with people where I've been fortunate enough and humbled enough to truly impact their life. It's great.
No, I can relate, especially in finance, having the ability to change people's life better for the future. And really, like you're saying, is you're affecting multiple generations. The example you gave was like the grandparent or something going to their grandchild's football game and they're able to enjoy it. It's the same thing here that we get in this industry where we have the ability to do things today that are affecting generations into the future. So it's an amazing thing. But is there any last things that you can think of that you would want to share? And I'll have one last question for you, but anything else on your mind?
No, I think I would just say to the audience, stay healthy, easier said than done. And when in doubt, go see somebody. Come see somebody like myself. And you may come to the office and it may be very clear that it's not time for joint replacement, but that's fine. That's a great conversation to have. You're connected to the system, whichever system or whatever system that is. You can get some good information. So yeah, don't be afraid to go look, but understand that it may not be time to have the surgery. And that's fine.
Yeah. It's just talking it through. And like you said, is you're just really trying to fact find and figure out where people are at with their pain and how it's affecting their life. And yeah, you'll do the surgery, but you want to make sure, is it the right time? Does it make sense?
Absolutely. And you know, I tell people all the time, I spend most of my day talking people out of surgery because I think it's generational, right? We don't like to accept any kind of, not that we're not tough, but you know what I mean? We expect things to be perfect almost. And a lot of times people come see me when it's a little too soon. But I also would say the people that make me more nervous are those who are extremely terrified for one reason or another. They know somebody who had a bad experience and their quality of life and their ability to enjoy it is just going down. Don't be afraid to come see somebody. Nobody's going to make you have surgery, but it's worth that conversation because I've been able to meet with people, kind of ease their fears and really, again, lucky enough to impact their lives.
That's amazing. So last question we always ask everyone on the podcast, if you have one message to the world, what would it be?
Be kind.
I like it.
Is that too simple?
No, I love it. It's simple. That's the whole thing. Like if we could end right there, that's the mic drop, right?
Be kind, treat people with respect, respect our differences. There you go.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know who you're going to run across in this world and how they're going to affect you, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Awesome, Trevor. A pleasure having you on. And anybody that wants to reach out to Trevor, don't hesitate to Google him, reach out. And you're still accepting new patients, correct?
Always. Absolutely. Happy to help in any way.
Awesome. Appreciate you. Thanks for being on.
Thank you for listening to the Holistic Wealth and Health Podcast. We hope we inspired you to make changes so you can live your best life. If you want to find out more about what we do, or if you want to have a holistic wealth and health financial plan, please call 456-833-7000. Please subscribe to the podcast and share it widely with your friends and family. Financial planning and advisory services are offered through Prosperity Capital Advisors, PCA, an SEC-registered investment advisor with its principal place of business in the state of Ohio. J.L. Smith Holistic Wealth Management and PCA are separate, non-affiliated entities. PCA does not provide tax or legal advice. Insurance and tax services offered through J.L. Smith Holistic Wealth Management are not affiliated with PCA. Information received from this podcast should not be viewed as individual investment advice. Product discussions and illustrations are hypothetical in nature and will vary based on many factors, including, but not limited to, age, health, product, insurance carrier, and product design. You should consult the insurance carrier website and policy for detailed information.
For information pertaining to the registration status of PCA, please contact the firm or refer to the Investment Advisor Public Disclosure website, www.advisorinfo.sec.gov. For additional information about PCA, including fees and services, send for our disclosure statement as set forth on Form ADV from PCA using the contact information herein. Please read the disclosure statement carefully before you invest or send money.